partial concordance liberation.
But very simple, they just say, the sharp know full enlightenment with ease,
the dull with hardship, it is said. So that's...
Where is it said? It's said in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, you see, so probably the 25,000 Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. So that's just pretty self-explanatory, though. I think those who practice those five virtues that we were just talking about, those would be the sharp ones, the ones who can practice them well. So therefore, they get to enlightenment easily or quickly. And those who aren't so skilled in, you know, all of those five, they'll have something holding them back. So they'll be the dull ones who achieve enlightenment with hardship. So that's about it for the path of accumulation then. So then the path of preparation is next. What time is lunchtime?
1 o'clock.
We don't have to break off early then. But we can remember to say that prayer, couldn't we? If you remind us. Yeah. So the next verses, dealing with the concordance with definite discrimination. So that's three verses, I think, here. Seventh topic of the fourth chapter. So why is it called the path of preparation? We know where it starts now with this union of calm, abiding, special insight, this meditative stabilization, which is, you know, the basis of really, you know, getting a bit of speed going on the path, a bit of, starting to get more skill, more mastery. And then it ends with the path that with seeing emptiness directly, or if you're on the hero vehicle, seeing selflessness directly. So that's when you pass off into the path of seeing. That's when you stop being an ordinary being. You start to be a superior being, an Arya being. And that must be like really revolutionary when you can see emptiness directly. So this is the preparation for that. Preparation for that kind of opening up to emptiness, sort of fully and completely, without any sort of conceptual categorizing of the mind going on. You just sort of your mind just sort of merges with emptiness then somehow, like water, like fresh water poured into fresh water, they say, when you realize emptiness directly. No thinking, no bringing it to mind through a conceptual image, but your mind just directly merges with it. So it's no longer like you're just seeing blue with your eye consciousness. Because even when we're seeing blue or something plain and obvious with our eye consciousness, there's no sense of which we sort of merge with the object, is there? There doesn't have to be any conceptual flow. It's just we can receive blue in our minds without, when we're looking at it with our eyes, without having to think about it. The baby who doesn't know hardly anything, the blue will come to their eyes as soon as they can focus them, won't they? So there's no problem about sort of being absorbed in blue in a very, sort of a baby-like, fascinated way. But the emptiness must be something much more than that, because all sense of any conceptual categories are then, is that somehow dissolved, isn't it? Somehow, because everything has the same quality of not having any identity, just from within itself, and you realize that that's the true fact about all phenomena, then somehow absorbing into that is very engulfing somehow, isn't it? It's very... You can't think about, I'm looking at emptiness anymore. You can't think like that. Because once you're doing that, you aren't absorbed into it, are you? Oh, now I'm seeing emptiness. Now I'm seeing emptiness directly. It wouldn't work. So, let's work towards it. Sounds great. Would be great relief. Well, they say everything has the same taste. Yeah, that's something like that, don't they? Everything has the same taste, a signlessness or whatever, you know, the same. You're no longer saying this is good, that's bad, is it? You're no longer making those discriminations. The emptiness of you, the emptiness of your guru, the indivisible, you know, you can't make a distinction between them. The emptiness of pot, the emptiness of pillar, there's no distinction between those. So that's the path of preparation, getting ready for that, you know, you're building up to that. But the other meaning, this one that never catches on, these long-winded ornament-type descriptions about partial concordance with definite discrimination. Well, I think this definite discrimination, we just take that to mean path of seeing, you know, when you finally discriminate emptiness as it should be, definite discrimination of emptiness, I think. So your partial concordance of that, you're getting nearer to that, you're having sort of a virtual experience of it, because you've got your supreme concentration and your supreme ability to analyze, you've got your meditative stabilization, which is a union of calm, abiding, special insight. So when you're looking at emptiness with that, it's like, you know, it's kind of, you know, the next best thing to actual definite discrimination. It's actual sort of, it's the almost partial concordance with seeing emptiness directly on the path of seeing. Yes? That's the name for the path of preparation, yeah. Did I? Well, the definite discrimination is the seeing. So this is the partial concordance with that. This is the kind of the halfway there, or, you know, getting there. It's the something similar to definite discrimination. So the path of preparation is the next stage previous to it. So it's the one that's nearly there, the one that's going to be there. So, see what I mean? Yeah, okay, good. What's the other word for it? The path, clear realization of the meaning. Yeah, all these paths are clear realizers. So the first one, the path of accumulation, is a clear realization of the doctrine. So now we've got a clear realization of the meaning. So that's only the inferential cognizer, though. So how could it get better than that? You're actually seeing the meaning. You're realizing the meaning. So what's the definition of the path of seeing, then? Or equivalent term for it. Yes, clear realization of the truth. So you're going one better than the meaning. You have a clear realization of the truth. It's a path of seeing. Path of accumulation. Path of meditation. Subsequent clear realizer. So you've got clear realization of the doctrine, path of accumulation. Clear realization of the meaning, path of preparation. Clear realization of the truth, path of seeing. Subsequent clear realization, path of meditation. Because path of meditation, you don't get any deeper understanding of emptiness. You're meditating more powerfully, maybe, with greater sense of concentration and, you know, greater powers from your side, but the object's the same. So it's a subsequent clear realization. You're just going on meditating on emptiness, you know, because it has to be a prolonged meditation to get rid of all your, you know, obscurations and afflictions and obscurations to omniscience and all that. So you do need a long meditation on it. So you have to come back to it again and again. Path of seeing is just the first time you realize emptiness. So when you've done that and, you know, arisen from it and everything, the next time you meditate will be the path of meditation. So the path of seeing is really quite short. It's only like the one realization, one session, and, you know, and that's done. And you've got rid of those objects of abandonment of the path of seeing in one session, like in one realization. So the path of seeing isn't all that long. Path of meditation can be, you know, very long. Can be another, maybe two countless great eons or something. So it's that's, you know, coming back to its subsequent realization. But still, we're on the path of preparation at the moment. So there's no special chapter or no special topic on the path of seeing or the path of meditation in this fourth chapter. In the 11 topics of the fourth chapter, we don't go through all the paths. We only talk about path of accumulation and the path of preparation. And in the path of preparation, we don't talk about the whole path of preparation. We only talk about the subsequent attainment part of the path of preparation. So what does that mean? Well, first of all, let me introduce some more vocabulary. Maybe we should read the verses, actually. So this is how it's presented in the text itself. So look at the verses again. Heat's observed object here is praised as being all sentient beings. It's taught that even-mindedness towards just them and so forth are its aspects 10. Oneself desists from evil and abides in giving and the rest, and thus brings others to take part in these. One speaks their praise in sympathy, through which the peak forbearance too, the truths known based in self and others both, and supreme quality is likewise known by way of ripening beings and such. Okay, so that's a bit, makes you scratch your head. But if you look on the right-hand side in the italics, you've got seventh topic, great vehicle concordance with definite discrimination. So then you've got heat, peak, forbearance, supreme, mundane quality. So these are four levels of the path of preparation. This is another complication of the path of preparation, that it has these four ascending levels. I'm not going to say much about them because it doesn't say much about them in the text here. You know, we're not talking about the whole of path of preparation, you know, in all its detail. We're only just focusing on some aspects of it. But we can say what the words kind of suggest. So heat is supposed to be like what you're working up towards is this non-conceptual direct realization of emptiness, and that is the path of seeing. So the heat is supposed to suggest, or the name is supposed to mean that you know, you think of that non-conceptual wisdom of the path of seeing as like fire, yeah? So it burns away your delusions. It burns away the rubbish in your mind and leaves it sort of, you know, clear and clean. So that's the fire of wisdom, the fire of non-conceptual wisdom. And here on the heat level of the path of preparation, you've got the first signs of that, the first indications of that heat. So it's like they gave an example of when you rub two sticks together to make fire. You know, you can make fire by rubbing sticks together. Then you'll get heat in the stick before you get flames, yeah? So this is like the heat in the stick before you get the flame. Have you ever made fire by rubbing two sticks together, Francesca? Have you? Onto tinder or something?
Yeah.
Does it work? Cotton wool works, does it? A flint and a piece of steel. Is any old steel okay, or do you have to have a special cut of steel? Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, I suppose that's how they used to do it in England more, because the wood would always be damp or something. So before we had matches, people would use a steel and flint, wouldn't they? Francesca can't afford matches, so she's still using it. Did you start your gas this morning? You wouldn't need cotton wool. I've seen it done in Sudan, actually, yeah. because, I mean, people there have matches these days, but a couple of times you showed me how you do it. But it has to be a special tree, you know, it's not any old tree. There's only one kind of, or a couple of species that have this, whatever, low burning point or something. So you have one piece of wood like that, and you have to dig a little notch in it, a little sort of dip, a little dimple, and then a little notch, I think, where the sort of, and then you have another stick with a point, so then you just rub like this. You know, then the stick with the notch goes into the dimple, and you just have to rub like this as vigorously as you can. And then this sort of little, this sort of semi-ignited, semi-burning little fragments start to fall down through this notch, and there you have your tinder or your cotton wool or something. And you blow on that, and it worked very well. It did one time, it did very quickly. So, yeah, before you get the flames, you'll have the heat in the wood, so that's the path of preparation. You feel the heat of non-conceptual wisdom coming on. So you get very, sort of redoubles your energy in your practice. So that's the name, the heat. And then the next one the peak, isn't it? Heat, peak, forbearance, supreme mundane quality. So peak refers to the peak of mundane virtue. So like we make this distinction, path of accumulation, path of preparation, mundane. You're still sort of worldly level. You're only working through concepts. Path of seeing onwards, you can have this sort of direct non-conceptual wisdom. So that's super mundane. You've gone beyond the world, they say. You're a superior being. And nobody can fall back from that, you know. So once you are a superior being, you stay that way, and so you're kind of it's sort of a step change, you know. So this, but by the time you get to the peak level of path of preparation, your mundane virtue has reached its highest level it's going to reach. It doesn't mean you go up and come down the other side like a peak in that sense, like a mountain peak, but it reaches its peak, it gets to the highest level, and then stays that way until you get to supra mundane virtue. And it means that your roots of virtue could be maybe destroyed by anger up until this point. You know, anger can interfere, damage your collection of virtue, and reduce it maybe. But from this point, pardon? It doesn't mean you could fall from the path, but your collection of virtue could be reduced. You know, could be. Could be lessened, I think, by, you should still get angry. I mean, you wouldn't fall from being on the path of preparation, but or being a bodhisattva, but you could still interfere, still, your amount of virtue could fluctuate downwards, yeah, because you've got angry or something. But now that's no longer possible, your virtue no longer can suffer any decline. It will always, you know, be increasing. So that's peak level. And then the forbearance level, this is saying you have forbearance towards emptiness. And I think that means that up until this point, you might have a fear of emptiness, you know, because it's so freaky to realize it or something, so earth-shattering or something. Or the thought of realizing it directly is a bit frightening. Well, I've heard people say that, yeah. They were saying, oh yeah, I can meditate on beginners, you know, not that people are like on the path of preparation, but, you know, meditating on external objects as being empty, or even yourself being empty, but then you're meditating your own mind being empty, so that's what you've got to sort of move towards, be able to do that as well. So that's a bit more scary, they said. So even the mind realizing emptiness, that's empty too. So then where do you end up? You know? Can you ever get back to where you were before? So, but somebody on the forbearance path of level of the path of preparation, the lack of fear arises then. They have more confidence. They're more able to bear meditating in emptiness without having to, I don't know. Yeah, but the Tibetan word is like the same word for the use of patience. So if you translate it more literally, the patience level, but it doesn't just mean patience with somebody who's irritating you or some having a, you know, an injury that's bothering you. So to try and keep with that word, you know, it's got to have something related to the meaning of patience, hasn't it? Well, you're no longer afraid, I think that's what it means. You're no longer so afraid, or, you know, that you lose everything. If you meditate in emptiness, you might just dissolve and never come back or something. You meditate in emptiness directly, you know, it might swallow you up or something. So you have to take some barbiturates or something. Yes. Does that say that in the handbook? It may do. We can have a look in a minute. Yeah, you're probably right. That's probably worth mentioning too. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this guy translated as poised residence, poised readiness. Is that right? Yeah, that's the one. It must. Yes. So he's probably translating a bit from the Sanskrit. So that is a different translation. Poised residence, poised readiness. But that would be like a bit of Sanskrit, eh? I can presume. I don't know what it is in Sanskrit. Yeah. So you're ready for it. You're ready for emptiness when it comes. Like, you're not going to be freaked out by it. Poised, I don't know, what's that supposed to mean? But Gareth Spaugham, he's got forbearance. So forbearance is probably the common translation. Yeah. And then the last one is supreme mundane quality, the fourth level of the path of preparation, supreme mundane quality. So here, it's like mundane meditation doesn't get any better than this. Yeah. So your mundane good qualities have really come to their limit. And after this, it will be super mundane. So that's the first thing to know in interpreting the meaning of the verses we've just read. The second thing to say is about this meditation, meditative equipoise and subsequent attainment. So also some more unfamiliar terminology for some of you. We did talk about it a little bit last week, but last session, but that may be just too briefly for people who've cottoned onto it. But each of these paths, like the path of seeing and the stages of the path of meditation, you know, you can say the path of seeing just as one stage, but the path of meditation has like 9 stages. Because each of the 10 grounds of bodhisattva is like the stage. So we're talking about these stages where you advance and destroy one level of the object of abandonment, which is the afflictions, or it's the obscurations to omniscience, whatever it is. So how do you destroy them? Well, you overcome them by this direct non-conceptual meditation on emptiness. So you can see, like, you're, let's say you're just going onto the path of seeing from the path of preparation. So finally, when you've got rid of the conceptual kind of, you know, the last sort of shade of the conceptual representation, the last kind of, you know, vague sort of shadow of it, which is obscuring seeing emptiness directly, when that is finally fades away, then you absorb into emptiness directly, this sort of, you know, meditative equipoise, they call it. So the mind is completely, like, absorbed into its object. And, so it's like the antidote is working on the objects of abandonment. Just like if you take your paracetamol for your headache, you know, there's a point, there's a time during which the antidote, the medicine, is tackling the symptoms, at least, or the disease. Let's say it's curing the disease, you know. I don't know what the paracetamol does, but it needs some time to work, right? It's not going to just take the paracetamol and immediately you feel better. Medicines don't work like that, do they? So there's a time at which the objects of abandonment and the antidote to it are abiding together. But they're not abiding together peacefully. They're abiding together where the antidote's harming the object of abandonment. What are you abandoning? What are you abandoning at this point? Yeah, what's the principal one? Wait, what ignorance? Ignorance, grasping at inherent existence. See, that's the object of abandonment. That's like the disease or something. And your wisdom realizing emptiness, that's the medicine. So that's a cure. So they're both there, but this one is harming that one. Yeah? It's like you feel really cold, you know, but you go and stand by a really huge fire. So the big blazing bonfire on bonfire night, you know, you stand next to it, you get nice and warm, don't you? So it doesn't happen immediately. You don't immediately feel warm, but, you know, the warmth just kind of gets to your body and, you know, just warms it all up, doesn't it? Except the smoke gets in your eyes as well. So that's what's happening. So it does take a little bit of time. So this is the meditative equipoise phase of the path of seeing. Yeah? Did you go to a bonfire on bonfire night? Get warm? Didn't bother? Well, you're from Hungary, you wouldn't care. Were you in England, or were you? Great British tradition. But we all love Guy Fawkes. If only he'd succeeded. Anyway. So that's what's happening, yeah? Just like heat drives away cold out of your body, but it just takes some time, yeah? And the antidote needs time to work. So that phase is a phase of, that's what they call that phase, this is a phase of the meditative equipoise part of the path, yeah? So you go into meditative equipoise, you realize emptiness directly, so that starts immediately then to destroy this first level of ignorance, together with its seeds. So when the destruction has taken place, so when you get to a certain point, that ignorance is destroyed and it won't come back again. It's not like you've just pacified it by, you know, just sort of cooling it down. You've actually vanquished it, so it doesn't come back. It's like you've cured yourself of it. So the first part of that meditative equipoise is where you are fighting against, you know, the antidote is fighting against the object of abandonment. That's the called the Branca. Yeah, but what part? Meditative equipoise, you can say, has two stages. This is the first stage called uninterrupted path. Uninterrupted path. It could be. Yeah. It's also in your last week's, your last handout, there's a description of them, which is wordy, but if you understand what I've been saying, then it'll make sense. What page is that? Well, now you know. The uninterrupted path is like one session of meditation where you kill off that level of disease, that level of ignorance, grasping at inert existence. So it's uninterrupted in the sense, I guess, it's just continuous, you know, until you can meditate for long enough and get through the harming process where one harms the other until the other one's no longer around. And then once you've got to that stage where the ignorance isn't going to come back, you're on the liberated part, the liberated path of the meditative equipoise session, you see. So meditative equipoise session has got two parts. One is where the antidote's doing the work. That's the uninterrupted path. When it's finished its work, but you're still meditating in emptiness blissfully away, so that's a liberated path. So you're liberated from that level of affliction. So that's meditative equipoise in two stages. Okay, so that's where you're doing your ultimate truth bit. You're absorbed into ultimate truth. But that's not the only part of the path of seeing. That's not the only part of the path of meditation. Because after that, you'll arise from your meditation on emptiness, but you'll still have work to do. You can meditate in the other five perfections. Meditate on bodhicitta. You can go and do your practical work of being useful in the world. But the subsequent attainment level refers to, I think, the other meditative practices. I think the subsequent attainment level has to have, if I'm not mistaken, the union of calm, abiding, special insight. So if you then go outside and start, doing beneficial work, I don't think that's subsequent attainment. You know, when you're just doing practical things where your mind is involved in making plans and so forth, that wouldn't be the subsequent attainment. The subsequent attainment is still kind of clear realizer. It's still meditating, dealing with building up your collection of virtue, collection of merit through meditation. It's not the actual practical actions you might do. I think so. So the path of seeing or the path of meditation, they have these different phases. As I say, in the path of seeing, there's only one session, one of each phase, and then you're onto the path of meditation. But the path of meditation has some sort of like nine stages of these, gradually getting rid of groups of afflictions, at a more and more subtle level. So that's the subsequent attainment stage, when you arise from your meditation in emptiness, so you're not just sort of single-pointed absorption into emptiness, but you're meditating on the other aspects of the path, obviously the vast aspects of the path of the aspects of, being beneficial to others. That's what the bodhisattva's concentrating on, isn't it? So do you understand what I mean by subsequent attainment now? Yeah? You've risen from your meditative equipoise and emptiness, and the meditation that comes, after that, or, the other five perceptions, let's say. Is that okay? A lot of information to take in if it's all new to you. Don't know how new it is. Some of you must be familiar. But it's on this picture, is it? On this diagram? Yeah, but now they move on to 10 perfections. Oh, it's done in those crossed lines, yeah. So the chevron type lines, the first part is the uninterrupted path, the second part is the liberated path, and then the white bit must be the subsequent attainment, I guess. Although it doesn't say so. No, because the subsequent attainment is there on the path of seeing also. You know, you've got uninterrupted path and liberated path, which you've just explained, but then the subsequent attainment, we're meditating on the other perfections. So that's also there. But on the path of meditation, you see how it happens many times, because there's many levels to move through. Yeah, probably a lot of these things are explained in the handbook, so look at them at your leisure. But what we have to say here is the path of preparation as it comes in the fourth chapter is only dealing with the subsequent attainment stage. The meditative equipoise stage of, like, you know, how you meditate in emptiness and the uninterrupted path and then the liberated path, that's not talked about here. So that comes in the first chapter, I think. So you see how we've got to be a bit selective here. Yes, you meditate on the wisdom, you get rid of the ignorance. And when it's got rid of, it's like you slam the door. Yeah? So like they say, it's like the uninterrupted path is when you're fighting with the thief. The thief's got into your house, but you're strong, so you can kick him out again. So you grab hold of the thief and you're struggling to get him out of the door. That's the uninterrupted path. Then when you kick him out the door, and you lock the door, so that's the liberated path. You see, you've got rid of the thief, but so you lock the door of the house, so then you can still stay peacefully in your house. That's the path of liberation, the liberated path. But then when you meditate on the other parts of the other perfections, that's the subsequent attainment, yeah? So that's what they're talking about in this chapter, the subsequent attainment bit. So this is method rather than wisdom, and the relevant place in the handbook now is page 132. So we look at the handbook, use the handbook a bit now for a change. So just look at that for a minute. There's different levels of the path of preparation, heat level, peak level, forbearance level, so on. Back in a minute. Did you used to be a gobser, Chola? Gobser. That's a Tibetan name, an old Tibetan name for Westerners.
Oh, I guess so.
Well, not necessarily. Yes, it sort of died out because, you know, it's not a very sophisticated word. It just means yellow hair, or yellow head, actually. Yellow head. So did you used to have blonde hair?
No.
No. I've got one there. Mine used to be blonde. But not that many Westerners. Was yours blonde at all, Stuart?
When I was six.
Really young, yeah. So the sort of that was their idea, the Westerners, that was a striking thing, the ones who had yellow hair, you know. Of course, a lot of us, you know, got brown hair, black hair, and so on. But Tibetans were kind of used to dark-colored hair, but they'd seeing people with yellow hair, blonde hair, you know, when the Westerners first went to Tibet, that's kind of what they picked up on. So that was the name, Gobser, and Gobser, it means like yellow hair, yellow head, really. Gobser. Gobser. But I think they realized it wasn't very polite, so they stopped saying it. Inji, like, and all foreigners were Injis, or all Western foreigners are Injis, yeah, because the first one they'd ever met were from England, I suppose. I mean, probably the soldiers who went there and beat up on them or something in the times of beginning of the 20th century. So all Westerners are Injis. No matter where you come from. Gobser, that was a good one. Well, that means English, doesn't it? Come on. You're an NG. True NG. Yeah, English, NG. Yes, so we've got all these things to meditate on, all these different points of the heat level. You see, this is what it's like, the perfection of wisdom. It's got so many points for each stage that you can get lost in them and never come out if you go into them all. But the art of studying this, I think, is not to go into them all, personally, you know. It's like when you go to an art gallery, you don't go and look at every painting and spend 5 minutes in front of it and then go to the next one, do you? You just go to one or two that look interesting and, you know, you get absorbed into those and they're very interesting then. But some of them you just leave out, don't you, and come back another time, or that's just not your style or something, so you don't bother looking at them much. So that's how you've got to tackle a text like this, I think. Some bits of it are really fruity and are really kind of, you know, juicy. Other bits, you know, well, that's for the specialist, they can, you know. But just to go through every point, you know, without mercy is a bit tough. So that's not the way we studied it in Dharamsala. But, you know, there's people who did insist on, you know, knowing everything. All the boys had to learn the whole text off by heart. But that was kind of inspiring to be able to chant it, you know. It's not just sort of conceptualizing every point. That's just enjoying the kind of, you know, the sacred music of it. But anyway, we're going to a few points here because these ones on the heat level, at least, they can form a meditation on the method side of the path, on bodhicitta. We can do this as a meditation, like after lunch, you know, in our last session this afternoon. So what it's saying is, what does a bodhisattva do when they're on the subsequent attainment phase of the heat level of the path of preparation? So that's the question. That's what's coming up in the text. So we have to get the verses here. This is verse 35. So it says, heat's observed object here is praised as being all sentient beings. Well, that's true of the heat level, of the peak level, of the forbearance level, and the supreme quality, supreme mundane quality level. They're all got the same observed object, so that's all sentient beings. You know, this is a bodhisattva. He's not just thinking about himself, all sentient beings. And then it's taught that that even-mindedness towards just them and so forth are its aspects 10. So the heat level of the subsequent attainment phase of the path of preparation is divided into 10, yeah? So there are 10 points. So these are spread out in over 3 degrees, aren't they? The small heat, middling heat, great heat. I don't think I have to worry too much about those. There's 10 types of attitude or 10 types of, you know, feeling towards sentient beings you have to cultivate. I'm not saying this is, you know, something that's unique to the path of preparation, because when you look at the points, it's like, well, everybody's doing those all the time anyway, so why do they have to bring them up here at the path of preparation, the heat level? I don't know. It's like, here's where you concentrate on them especially, or I don't know, it isn't really, but anyway, that's how they come in the text. So this is a chance here, you know, to review them. So let's just go through them from the handbook, right, page 132, 133. So in the verse, it just says even-mindedness and so forth, yeah? Even-minded towards them and so forth, towards all sentient beings. So it's so forth includes the other nine. So the first one, even-mindedness or equanimity. So the Bodhisattva regards all sentient beings equanimously, ceasing attachment and aversion to them. Okay, so we are all familiar, I hope we're all familiar with this from, planned out kind of meditations on bodhicitta that you can do, the six causes and one effect, or the exchanging self and others, these sort of more, what do they call them, more carefully like thought out, you know, make things easy, put things in the right order, you know, let's make a graded step-by-step approach to bodhicitta. Here it's a bit more mixed up, but we're all familiar with this first one anyway. Even-mindedness, equanimity. And then the second one, we go to mind of love. The Bodhisattva regards all sentient beings with a mind of love as well as with a mind of compassion. These two attitudes accompany each other, one being manifest when the other is not. Love wishes all sentient beings to have happiness and its causes, while compassion wishes them all to be free from suffering and its causes. Okay, so compassion is not going to be mentioned separately here. So we go from being even-minded to all sentient beings to have a mind of love for them, wishing them to have happiness. Okay, so that's the small heat level. And then middling heat, mind of benefit. So a bodhisattva thinks how to benefit, help and serve sentient beings. He tries to think of all the possible ways and means to benefit sentient beings, not harm them. There are many ways to harm sentient beings. One should avoid harming them physically, verbally, and mentally. So, if you can't benefit them, then don't harm them. But here we try to have a mind which aspires to benefit them and thinks how to benefit all sentient beings. So those, those are positive minds of in the Bodhisattva vein, aren't they? And then we have a mind of non-anger and mind of non-harmfulness. So these two go together, and have something more to say about those. But first, let's read in the book. This bodhisattva does not become angry with other sentient beings. It is good if we also strive not to become angry. When anger arises in us, it creates unhappiness for both ourselves and for other sentient beings. Yes? So this is not talking about not harming others, but not even becoming angry with them. So, the bodhisattva just trains not even to become angry, of course. But even if he does become angry a little bit, well, he doesn't let it out. He doesn't harm others. You see, it's saying on this level, the bodhisattva still can become angry. It says he still can damage his roots of virtue. At this level, his mundane virtues haven't peaked yet. So anyway, even if he does a little bit, it's you don't let it out. So you don't let your mind wishing to harm other translate into action. Number 5, mind of non-harmfulness. The bodhisattva is not mean, directly or indirectly. We should practice likewise. It is very easy for us to be harmful. Sometimes people do not harm others directly, but indirectly they inflict. Okay. So I'm just going to leave those there and then come back to them. And just run through the other 6 to 10 points, right? So you've got the mind of a mother and father. So Bodhisattva regards sentient beings who are of a similar age to her parents as her father and mother. So this is seeing all sentient beings as your mother, but doing it in different sort of grades of age. The ones that are older than you and so forth, you see as your father and mother. Then mind of a brother and sister. So the ones who are more or less the same age as you or same generation, then you think of those as your brother and sister, and you know that's cultivating love and warmth towards them. And then mind of a son and daughter. So those of the next generation, the ones who are younger than you, to that degree, then you think of those as your, try to think of those as your son or daughter. So having a mind of love towards them and wishing to care for them as if they were your child. And then there's also a mind of a friend and companion. The Bodhisattva regards and treats sentient beings who are equal in age as himself, as his friends and companions. Then he says, companions are those with whom one shares one's life, such as one's girlfriend or boyfriend, and so forth. I'm sure Asanga would never have written that. And then the mind of paternal relatives or maternal kinsmen. The Bodhisattva regards and treats, it must be older sentient beings, but they've already had mother and father, so this one, I don't know. He treats sentient beings, maybe older sentient beings, I don't know, as paternal and maternal relatives, grandfather, grandmother, and so forth. So those are ones who are quite a bit older than you, or what, I don't know. So I don't know where those materials are coming from by way of explanation. But in addition to those points, filling out number 4 and 5, have you got your paper from last week, the previous weekend? This is the October weekend. Because at the bottom of page 3, I put a selection from Asanga giving his suggestions about not becoming angry, avoiding anger. So this is this is selected from his explanation of the perfection of patience. So he's got this text called the Bodhisattva Grounds, which is a huge text on, you know, the way of the Bodhisattva. It's not verses like Shantideva's where the Bodhisattva is. This is a written, you know, prose text, sort of giving all the different meditations, all the different procedures for being a Bodhisattva, you know, from all different angles, the vows and, you know, the perfections and the practice of each perfection, how to meditate. So a great amount of, you know, very learned stuff. So he didn't just take down Maitreya's dictation for the Ornament for Clear Realizations. He didn't just have that vision of Maitreya and become his ghostwriter for the ornament. He also wrote great works in his own right, and this Bodhisattva Grounds is probably one of his great volumes, one of his largest works. So the question is, how does a Bodhisattva forbear and endure the harm that is carried out against him or her by others? So we could look at that, but it's a bit, you know, a bit more reading, so I think just we'll keep it on hold there, and maybe we'll try to bring it in our afternoon meditation, because that's when we're going to be trying to, you know, do a bit of practice, so that can be our focus for practice this afternoon, okay? I mean, it'll take a bit long to read it now. But we'll see. Because I just want to get through this bit on the path of preparation, you see. So that covers the heat level of the path of preparation. So that's apparently what the Bodhisattva is meditating on when they're meditating on the heat level. So the three heat levels, small, middling, and great heat levels of the subsequent attainment phase of the great vehicle called concordance with a portion of definite discrimination, as it comes in the fourth chapter, the application in complete aspects of the ornament. So we're going to meditate on that. So if you can tell people, yes, I've meditated on the heat level of the subsequent attainment phase of the great vehicle, partial concordance with definite discrimination, as it is found in the fourth chapter of the Ornament for Clear Realizations by Maitreya, people are going to say, wow, advanced meditator, amazing, you know, let me do three prostrations. I survived that meditation from Geshe Graham. Yeah, so that's what we're trying to do. But we should go to the, just look at the other levels, peak level, forbearance level, and supreme mundane level. Supreme mundane quality level of the path preparation. So that's in the next lines. So for the peak level, it says, one desists from evil, this is verse 36, one desists from evil and abides in giving and the rest, and thus brings others to take part in these. One speaks their praise in sympathy. So maybe not going too much into the words of the handbook, but it's all there. Basically, there's three things going on. There's placing, and then praising, and some kind of rejoicing or sympathy. So that's repeated for the peak level, the forbearance level, and the supreme mundane level. They all have those three activities, somehow placing, praising, and this rejoicing or sympathizing. So you can see there are also three levels of each of these other last three levels of the peak of the path of preparation. They also have small, middling, and great. Well done. But basically, it's saying in the text, first of all, going back to the verses, yeah, peak level, one desists from evil and abides in giving and the rest. So you yourself avoid doing wrong things, and you abide in doing the six perfections, giving and the rest. And so by setting that example, other people come to do the same thing. So that's how you place other people in doing those activities, just by giving them a good example, and they follow on. So that's what it means. You place people in those activities by showing them the way, by doing it yourself, and the other people are inspired to do the same. And then you also praise people who do it. And it says in the at the peak level that you verbally express praise for those who engage in these things without being urged to do so, just following your example or something. You don't actually have to tell them. You don't have to urge them. You're just given an example and they follow. So that's praising. One speaks their praise in sympathy. Now, in the handbook, it says rejoicing. Yeah, and in celebrating, or another way of translating the word is something like just agreeing or sympathy. So you're in tune with them. You show your good feelings about what they're doing, you know, and sympathize with them and encourage them, or rejoice in what they're doing. So that's three activities then: placing, praising, rejoicing. See, so once you get out to some detail like this, some quirky things coming up, but that's not too quirky, that's not too bad. Anyway, just explaining the meaning of the text so you can see that when you get into the detail of the text, you know, how you can unpick the words. It seems quite strange the way it's expressed, but it's just a very condensed explanation of the meaning. So verse number 37, through which the peak, forbearance 2. So this is basically the same: placing, praising, rejoicing. So in the rest of the three levels, it's the same three activities, slightly different. It says through which the peak forbearance to the truths known, based in self and others both. So here it's more emphasizing knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. So you have the knowledge yourself, and you place others in that knowledge of the Four Noble Truths, and so forth. So, it's just a bit more related to the Four Noble Truths and other things, you know, which we won't bother going into here. So the peak and the forbearance, pretty similar in that sense. And then the supreme mundane quality is more or less the same again. The supreme mundane quality is likewise known by way of ripening beings and such. So here, the positive activity that you lead by example and kind of place others into is the positive activity of ripening other sentient beings. So you do that, and other qualified sentient beings are inspired to do the same. They also take up the activity of ripening other sentient beings, and so forth. You know, they go down through the list, but that's just one as an example. So then when you've given a good example, they follow you, and then you praise them, and especially you praise the ones who take up the activity without needing to be kind of urged to do so. And then again, the mind of sympathy, encouragement and being in tune with them for the good activities that they're doing. So that's something about the way you train your mind when you are in the subsequent attainment phase of those last three levels of the path. Well, this is the method side. What's wrong with that? But are those other bits the...
We talked about it earlier in terms of our relationship with the wisdom and understanding.
Hmm.
So that's the wisdom aspect.
Yeah. So those names, they're coming from just why each level is called by that name. So what's some distinctive feature of the practitioner on that level that you can say about them, okay, now, or how they can look at themselves, or now I've got the heat of, I'm really getting enthusiastic about being able to see emptiness directly, and I'm really getting the understanding can be done. Now I've got this concentration of, meditative stabilization, which is concentration of calm abiding, mixture of union of calm abiding and special insight. Now I really get to feel that my meditation can become powerful enough to actually see emptiness directly. So you sort of, that's kind of the heat of non-conceptual wisdom sort of beginning to arise, So that's a name given because of some distinctive feature, I suppose.
So the names come from distinctive features in terms of the level of the depth of understanding and the activities of this material.
Yeah, but then the other names, one is what, the peak of mundane virtues. It's like that's your mundane virtues have got as good as they're going to get. Forbearance, you've got the confidence that when you do realize emptiness directly, you won't be blown away by it. You won't just go to pieces. You'll still be here afterwards or something. Or however you are here after meditating, realizing emptiness directly, it'll be okay. You'll be changed forever, but manage, because you've got enough love for sentient beings to carry through the fear of nihilism, whatever it is, So yeah, it's the features all relate. They don't all relate to emptiness, do they? The peak of mundane virtue and all that, supreme mundane quality. This is as good as it's going to get for an ordinary being before they become a superior being. Sort of generalistic. Really. Yeah, so plenty of food for those who can get familiar with these things. But if you wanted just a summary, if all that's a bit bewildering, just look at the last, on page 135, it says conclusion. I'm just going to read the last six lines of the conclusion. So there's a handbook, page 135, conclusion, just the last six lines. So that's just like a little summary, yeah? On the heat level, the Bodhisattva generates 10 types of virtuous minds towards sentient beings. So that's what we'll meditate on. On each of the peak forbearance of some supreme mundane quality levels, the Bodhisattva generates 3 types of minds. 1, the mind of placing others in positive activities. 2, the mind of expressing praise for those who engage similarly without being urged. And 3, the mind of rejoicing in those who act accordingly. Likewise, we should try to practice in all these ways. So that's just, you know, going down to the detail, getting down to ground level. So we've looked at a couple of verses in depth. Well done. Then if you turn over the page, you've got signs of irreversibility. So this is the next topic. We've finished the path preparation. I'm just rushing us a bit now because this will form a discussion point for the session after lunch. Signs of irreversibility. So only got 5 minutes. So, you know, questions are very welcome, but we just got to set the discussion point for after lunch. So irreversibility means you don't turn back from Buddhahood, right? You don't turn back from your path. Now, I said before that even if you're on the middling level of the path of accumulation, you've got to the point where you don't turn back. If you're a very new bodhisattva, just on the small beginner's path of accumulation, then it's possible to drop out. You're possible to lose your bodhicitta. But once you're on the middling path of accumulation, it's kind of, you're going to go all the way then. Might take a long time, but you're not going to sort of draw back. You're not going to turn back. So these signs of irreversibility, they come some on the path of preparation, some on the path of seeing, some on the path of meditation. So even though people are irreversible by the time they're on the middling path of accumulation, still there are these signs of irreversibility that come along later, which I don't quite understand why that is. But we're not going to bother about that. What I wanted to say was, your discussion is something like these signs of irreversibility is, if you have a root guru, you know, if you have somebody you take as your guiding light in your life, which quite a few probably do, or if not, they're your root guru or something, people here will have somebody who they do take seriously as their teacher. So what are the signs by which you take that person to be your teacher? You know, what makes you decide that person is genuine and not come some kind of person just with a load of charisma but not much else, you know, who's like bewitching and carries you away and you know, sort of have, oh yes, they're sort of an amazing person, but later on you're disappointed because they turn out to be, you know, shiny on the outside, but inside they don't kind of quite live up to your expectations or something. So what are your criteria by which you have judged or you would judge somebody to be your definite, you know, spiritual friend, definite spiritual guide? So it's something to do with this chapter. It's not like you can go in, you can look at the signs in the chapter, but you won't find quite what we are talking about here. They're not quite the sort of signs that you might expect. Well, what signs would we expect? I don't know. So that's a discussion. You've got to decide what made you think, oh, this person is my spiritual teacher. How did you build up to that kind of conviction? So what does it take? Just interested. So that's the discussion point for 20 minutes after lunch. So how long is the lunch hour? Is it an hour or an hour and a quarter? Hour and a half. So that would be, is that okay? 2:30 to 2:30? But last time we had an hour and a quarter, didn't we? Okay, well, we come back at 2:15 then. Or try to. What about saying that dedication prayer for our food then? Are there some copies available in the... I'm not sure it's in there, is it? Not dedication, but offering prayer. Food offering. Did I say dedication? Om Mahum, to the precious Buddha peerless guide, to the precious Dharma peerless refuge, to the precious Sangha peerless liberators, we offer to the three jewels of refuge. This food with 100 flavors, attractive and well prepared, is offered to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas with devotion. May all beings enjoy the wealth of the food of concentration. Saying this food is medicine, we eat it without attachment or hatred, not out of avarice, pride, or a wish for an enviable body, only to sustain the body.